Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop, and we are super excited to have on our guest today. This guy is an absolute legend in the world of mixing, particularly, and pro audio in general. The name Michael Brower hopefully is familiar to you. If it's not, I don't know where you've been hiding. Michael Brower, when he talks, people listen. When he changes his bus compressors, people say, I wonder if I should change bus compressors too. When Michael Brower sneezes, people say, is that the kind of tissue paper I should be using on the tweeters to my NS10s? I hope there's enough audio nerds in our audience to find that fairly amusing. Did I do okay with that one, Michael?
I'm okay with that.
I got a giggle out of Brower. All right, that's good. If you can get Brower giggling, you're doing a good job. All right, so we're going to dive deep into a conversation with this guy, and I think we're going to cover a lot of interesting ground. When we're talking about topics to dive into, one of the things that came up was this idea of overcoming the fear of mixing, the things that are making you take too long, stopping you from doing your best work. We'll kind of riff on that idea and go to a bunch of places. In case you're not too familiar with his credits, I mean, the big ones that come up a lot are huge hits for John Mayer, for Coldplay. He did a Grizzly Bear record a few years back that I really liked, James Bay a bit more recently, a whole bunch of great stuff. Michael Brower's been doing this a long, long time. Michael, would you say you've been in this field 30 years?
43.
Wow, my goodness. And you don't look
at my first record was with Luther Vandross. Actually, Change. That's how far back it goes.
Wow. Another thing he's been doing a surprisingly long time is mix with the masters. And I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of Michael Brower's been involved with the mix with the masters. But I don't think everyone realizes he's one of the co-founders of Mix with the Masters. He was one of the very first seminars ever done. And it's been like a partnership with you and the other co-founders over there, right?
Yes.
All right, wonderful. Now, before we get into this conversation, got to give a quick shout out to our sponsors. Here it is, your 90 seconds or so of pure bliss. As I shout out first, iZotope, new sponsor on the podcast. Big fan of these guys.
Love them.
Yeah, they make great stuff. Literally not a day goes by that I don't use iZotope's ozone on something in my mastering work. Even if I'm going through a big analog mastering chain, there's always something, whether it's the dynamic EQ or the spatializer or something that I'm using. Their RXD Noiser is amazing. A lot of people are really interested in their kind of next-gen mixing tool, Neutron. But they make synths. They make vocal sweeteners. Check them out at iZotope.com. You can check out anything they make for free over there. Another sponsor for this week's podcast, a brand that has been in business probably roughly about as long as Michael Brower, and that is Eventide, making some of the most forward-looking effects like since the 1970s. Amazing multi-effects processors, and today they're still making forward-looking effects, as well as great hardware, stomp boxes, effects units. You got anything by Eventide there in your room right now?
Well, no, but I certainly have their software that I love.
There you go. It's, that counts. You know, it's
basically exactly what I had when it was hardware. So yeah, it sounds just as good. And their 910s are awesome. I mean, you name it. It's, you know, I mean, when we only had a couple of toys, even Tide was one of them back a long time ago.
And they just started to reissue some of the older stuff again. They're doing the instant flanger and the instant phaser, which are on like you hear these things and you're like, I know that sound, you know, that's major. And then last, certainly not least, sponsor from the beginning on this podcast, Soundtoys. Big shout out and thanks to
Love Soundtoys.
Yeah. So check out anything they make for free over at soundtoys.com. They are making probably some of my favorite plugins for creative mixing effects. The Decapitator, Devilock Deluxe, the Echo Boy is a favorite for everybody. So much great stuff. Check them out at soundtoys.com. All right. Without further ado, Mr. Michael Brower, thank you for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Just drove down from the Catskills in pouring rain. So I'm glad to be here. I'm glad I didn't get stuck in traffic.
All right. Good stuff. So I see you are in a space. I think we have to get this out of the way first. I want to get into this whole idea of mixing faster and mixing more confidently, which, I mean, you're like a paragon of confidence, I think, in the audio world. I think a lot of people can learn from that. But behind you, I do not see a big fat analog console, which is one of those things that people are probably used to.
We have the S6 32 channel, just updated with its newest software, so I don't know what it's going to do. Maybe fly itself. And love it. I just love it. Yeah. And, you know, understand, I started on a Neve on 8068. And then we went from there to an SSL, which was shocking. I mean, it was shocking to the system, shocking to the ears, because their first generation was, oof, those EQs, you couldn't even breathe on them. It was, you know, it was just, it's a different sound. It was a completely different sound. And since then, you know, from that first 4,000 to the 6,000 to the 8,000 to the 9,000, it just got better, better, and better, and better. And so my whole career for mixing has basically been around SSL.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you maybe later on in the podcast in a little more detail about your current setup. But before we get into that, I think one of the things that surprises people who don't know your process, and some people maybe think if they've read articles about your process and how you use multi-bus compressors and that stuff, maybe they think of it as a complex process. But that seems to be kind of on the back end, because when you're mixing, you mix fast, I think. How quickly do you mix, and do you think that's normal, or do you think it's something that people should strive for? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think why I mix fast isn't necessarily related to my setup. Certainly, I can get ideas out very, very fast. But at Media Sound, we'd learn to mix quickly. If we did mix a song in 2 or 3 hours, it just was not cool. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we generally mixed 3 or 4 songs a day. Right. And that was just the norm. I mean, you know, it just was the norm. So that just continued on, because for me, I always looked at it as a performance. I didn't want to get hung up on soloing something for 3 or 4 hours or just, you know, getting to the point where I had lost any joy in mixing the song because I'd heard it too many times. There are definitely exceptions. If a song is super complicated and there's, you know, it's going to require just a lot more surgery or a lot more thinking or a lot more direction, of course, you know, then if it takes a day, it takes a day. I, you know, it's not like I need to get out of here, but I just love to, it's like learning a new song, you know, when the band's playing and you get to that point, you go, oh, it feels great. That's the point where I start basically turning automation on. And so generally, you know, I come in at 10, I listen to the song, I listen to the rough mix, I get an idea of what's going on, and I start mixing. And then generally by 1:30 at the latest, I'm completely done. It's I give it to Fernando just to make sure that the de-essing and or any noises or anything like that are taken care of, and then up it goes.
Yeah. I think bankers would be envious of your hours. That's it's good stuff.
But then I'll mix a second one.
Yeah, there you go. Now, is that a lot easier when the tracks have a similar setup as far as the way that they were recorded and produced? Or is there additional stuff on the back end that, say, Fernando, your assistant, is doing for you to make sure that they're in a close enough place where you can kind of get in and be that creative and spontaneous?
Well, Fernando's a great, great asset. I mean, he's prepping the session for me, right? So he's making sure that the way I like to see it show up on the S6, where the drums are, the bass is, each one, is it assigned to A, B, C, or D? All those things he knows that I, you know, the way I like to hear things. I mean, the way I like things set up in front of me. And that's it. And then all the sounds and whatever I want to put on it, you know, that's what I'm doing.
Wonderful. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny when I first, when it first started being something that I saw talked about online that, oh, these big mixers, some of them are mixing fast, but yeah, those guys have assistants. And sure, I'd be mixing a lot faster if I had an assistant setting up things for me too. But then I start thinking, well, why don't you get an assistant then? And I mean, even if you're not necessarily a huge billing, you know, top flight mixer, people can involve assistants and others in their craft, I think, earlier on. And I think when you got started in this world, it was kind of taken for granted that music production to a degree was a team sport, you know? And
oh, totally.
Yeah.
Because I was recording and then mixing. So, I mean, I had an assistant. Yeah. You know, I needed an assistant at all times. And of course, he had to be taking the recall notes, which right. was quite intensive.
Yeah.
And back then.
And that's something that I want to encourage people, like, you don't necessarily have to be at Michael Brower status yet if you don't have an assistant who you trust to start working on the stuff with him. I mean, my goodness, there's so many people out there looking for opportunities in the field, and there's such hunger for those that working with someone who's even just a few years ahead of you could be, you know, a huge opportunity for some people getting started and a huge opportunity for people who haven't brought that into their workflow yet because they think it's not for them because they're not in some big Manhattan studio?
Well, I think it's obviously an advantage, and it saves time for me because mentally I just sit down and I mix.
Yeah.
I don't have to do the preparation for it. But I think I've spoken to many people about this, and for many of them, it's just a luxury that they can't have. They're not bringing in the kind of money that is going to be then divided to, you know, to be given to an assistant, and or having to depend on an assistant. Where I just think it's quite the luxury. And when people say, "Yeah, I know," but by the time I start mixing, I've already been prepping for an hour or two, and I've been, you know, I've been pitching, and I'm just so worn out, and I've got to mix. And I said, "You know, you're right." And when you're doing something like that, you should select one day to do your prep day,
right?
And do three or four songs, mm-hmm. and then the next day sit down and start mixing.
Yeah.
If you don't have that luxury of an assistant, don't go through all this pre-production wearing yourself out. Mixing, you need to just walk in there as excited and kind of the song needs to be fairly new to you. So if you can get away from it for a day or, you know, as much as you can, I think that's a much better way than prepping, right. mixing, doing the post-production.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely a great point. And as far as keeping things fresh, when you first start and you first start pulling things up, are you listening to rough mixes beforehand? Are you listening to references beforehand? I mean, how fresh are you coming in when you're coming in fresh?
I always listen to the rough mix first. I mean, today's rough mixes are usually kind of ongoing masters that mm-hmm. they just weren't quite able to nail.
Right.
So I usually try to have a conversation with the artist or the producer to find out how close is this rough mix for you? You know, is it 80% there? Is it really whacked and I shouldn't listen to it, which I will never pay attention to them when they say never listen to it, because when they say don't listen to it, the first thing they say is, well, you know, in the rough mix, you know, that guitar. It's like, I knew it. But I try to find out what is it they like about the rough mix and what is it that they don't like about it. And if I don't have the ability to speak to anyone, then I determine that on my own. I go, what do I like about it? Okay, well, then I'm going to keep that. You know, sometimes that rough mix is really, really good. And so what am I doing here? You know, and I start to thinking, why did they call me? This mix sounds great. Yeah. I go, all right, well, maybe, you know, maybe the focus is a little bit too much towards this and it should go towards that, you know, and maybe improving the drum sound and the vocal sound is really all it needs, but all the internal balances should be maintained, where it's panned and the depth and basically the feel of the song is good. It could just be better.
Right.
A rough mix is very important to me.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, the same thing happens to me. That's the biggest crisis of confidence I get these days sometimes is when something comes to me and is really good and I'm doing mastering on something and I'm like, oh man, I'm going to have to send this back to them having barely done anything and bill them anyway. And that's the crisis of confidence I get these days when it's great.
But that the experience of what to touch, if it's only 10%, that's the experience of what 10%? The wrong 10% is going to suck. And then they're going to go, wow, you know, you really took it in the wrong direction. But if you're loving what it is and to determine what are those two or three elements when everything is feeling so good. And I think, again, that's where the experience really comes in on that.
So speaking of getting things feeling good, I think one thing I notice in your mixes in particular, and I have a lot of great mixers, is just how much the mid-range makes sense. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes is wrong in the mixes that I get from people who are beginners, where it almost sounds like they're focusing too much sometimes on the low end or the top end, and they forget about the whole middle of the song, you know? And it seems like things make sense in the mid-range. Things aren't walking on top of each other. There's always a focal point, and the focal point is, you know, it's kind of definitive. So give me a sense for how you work so specifically well in the mid-range area and decide which things should be featured and focused.
That's a really good question. And somebody just recently had said that, wow, your mid-range is so special. And I'm like, it is? I had no idea. And when I think about it, it's, well, you know, the bottom end is your feel. And your top end is, you know, the ear candy. But the middle of the song is your message. That's where your emotion is. That's where the energy, that's where the storytelling is. So I look at it that way. And so as I'm mixing, if something needs to, you know, I'm doing a lot more attenuation and boosting in that area, not necessarily always using a fader to go up and down. I'll get that fader where it feels good, but then just to make sure that it fits, that the guitars work well with, you know, the synths or the piano or the vocal. I want to be sure that the vocal is sitting in its own area, not only from a level standpoint, but from an EQ standpoint, so that there isn't a lot of fighting going on in the same frequency area. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I really just recently have to think about how to articulate better, because I never really thought about it. I always thought about, well, the bottom end has to feel a certain way to me. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just, you know, when I turn up the speakers, a kick and the snare and the bass, I physically want to feel it somewhere on my body. Mm. And then the mid-range is, I just want to be excited by it. I want those things to pop out of the speakers, but I don't want everybody to pop in that same area, because then it becomes harsh.
Yeah.
And so that fine line between harsh and too bright and warm, mm-hmm. or too warm, is something that I've been teaching, you know, mixed with masters for 10 years, and I've never been asked that question or had to articulate how to go about that.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a, well, I'm going to have to really put my thinking hat on. But I think a lot of this is just driven by the story.
Right.
So, you know, I've got the vocal right there, nice and present. I don't want it too bright. I don't want it too thin. I don't want it too dull. You know, mm-hmm. all the things. So you're listening to the story and you're not being distracted by the sonics of it. And then everybody else kind of supports the vocal. And so where do I want the horns to be? Well, I don't want the horns to be in the same range as the guitar, because one is going to blur the other. So it's just a matter of EQing. But I really like to see, if I'm looking at a profile, you got your top end, you got your mid-range, it kind of almost looks like a nose, you know, mm-hmm. and then it goes back a little bit, and then the bottom end, like a big butt,
right?
You know, at the bottom. It's got pants. And that's kind of how I'm hearing it. Now, I mix on Pro Axe and ATCs, but I also listen to everything on my little Sony boombox. Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing everything just a little bit different when it comes to the mid-range, you know, right. But I like to have a happy place where the vocal is still driving the song, when of course it's appropriate that the song is driven by the vocal and it's not just one of the instruments.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the genre, but I think people are often surprised in pop music when they hear their record against some of their references, just how prominent the vocal is allowed to be in a lot of the pop idiom. And I think that's one thing that a lot of beginning mixers maybe don't have the confidence to do sometimes. Having a great vocal makes it a lot easier to push that forward confidently. But I imagine that this, I like this idea that you have, is that ideally, if you have a good looking enough person, that they have a nose that's sticking out a little bit, that's the mid-range, but not too much, right? And then right. Hopefully their belly isn't sticking out as far as their nose. That's something you want generally in your ideal human being. And then you've got to have some badonk, even if you're a dude. But I imagine the exact amount of badonk that you have and the exact placement of said badonk and nose is going to vary slightly based on aesthetics, right? There are certain records you mix
so.
Where you push different portions of the mid-range, I'd imagine.
Exactly. And I think the way many of us, you know, if you look at how Chris does his mid-range, or Andy Wallace does his, you know, or Chad Blake or Shakir, or, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, or Spike or Manny, of course, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's where kind of their personality is seen, or maybe their little print, is just how do they approach that mid-range. Of course, it's how do you approach the bottom end and top end too. Certainly the way Manny does his bottom end is, you know, is phenomenal. But every one of them has a unique approach that you can keep hearing again and again, but it's still transparent enough that it doesn't take away from the song itself, which is what we all try to be, you know, very, very aware of, that we're not putting an imprint on that mix. You want to be as transparent as possible, but maybe if you go, wow, you know how that vocal feels to me, that emotion, well, that's got to be Brower mixing that. Or that's got to be, you know, Chris mixing that, because there's just a certain emotional approach you're taking to a particular song that is happy or angry or sad.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the unique personalities come out from the different guys. Right. Because we can all, you know, we can take that, you give that song to five of us and we're going to probably do it all different.
Right.
But it's still going to be good, which is the best. Which is the best that the artist wants,
right?
Not what is the best among us.
Once you're talking about names like that, it really comes down to, you're not going to get someone doing a better job than another. It's much more, you're going to get someone doing a different job than another, and which personalities fit best for a particular project. I also want to say something really quick about all those names you threw out. If any of you listening at home can't fill in the last name of each of those people he just mentioned, you should get on that. And that means you haven't studied the work of other really prominent, amazing mixers enough. And now you know these guys on a first name basis because you've met, I imagine, all of them in person, or at least the vast
most of them are very close friends of mine.
But if you don't hear the name Manny in this context and fill in Marroquin, if you don't, you know, hear Chad and fill in Blake, if you don't hear, you know, Spike and fill in his last name, you really got to study the work of people who are good at this and get a sense for what's consistent about the way they work and what is the artist. And I think once you can hear another mixer's voice to a degree, you learn a little bit more about finding your own voice as a mixer. So this is a long setup for a question, which is, today, do you study the work of other mixers, or do you try to keep a distance from the work of other mixers? How do you approach that balance in your own work today?
Well, there's an interesting story to that. No, I don't listen, except for once. I don't listen to what anyone else is doing. The way I started when I was at Media Sound is I was so afraid that if I listened to what anybody else did, I just want to quit. Because they were so good. I mean, even the guys at Media Sound were Bob Clearmountain, Michael DeLug, Harvey Goldberg, Tony Bon Jovi, Alan Varner, Michael Barbiero. I mean, Ron St. Germain, Godfrey Diamond. I mean, it goes on and on. They were just all great, great, hot guys. And of course, I was assisting for them, so that was cool. You know, it was intimidating enough because they were each so good. But then the idea of listening to anybody else's records and then trying to compare it to myself as opposed to going, what can I learn? It was too frightening. So I only listened to my own records that I would record and mix and see how I can improve those. Uh-huh. And I think along the way, I was developing my own sound, but it was really totally out of fear, right, that I would be so intimidated by hearing that somebody else would be, because already it was enough that when you're listening to what Clearmountain or Bon Jovi or any of those guys were doing, that was already like, whew, oh my God, you know, right? So for, I don't know, first 7 years, I never listened to anything else. And then one day, my best friend at the time, Harvey Goldberg, goes, you know, have you heard Phil Collins, you know? And I was like, no, and you know why, you know, because you got to hear how it was recorded, you know. And I listened, he made me listen to it, and I was like, oh my God, who is this guy who's engineering? And this was done at the townhouse, and it was the sound, you know, and it was Hugh Padgham recorded, and we're listening to the drum sound, and it's got this, you know, this big but short sound, and it was just so new and so exciting. And I said, okay, all right, let's start working on that. But of course, I was doing R&B at the time, Luther Vandross, so you know, I couldn't get drums to sound like that, even though I started to try to sneak it in. He'd go, oh, Michael, what are you doing? You know, like, oh, I'm just trying to make the drums sound more exciting. No, I don't want to hear room. I don't want to hear room in R&B.
Oh, man. Like,
okay.
Yeah, it is a totally different feel.
But, you know, the only other time that I actually listened to anyone else was when Dream Theater had approached me and they said, hey, you know, we want you to mix our record. I was like, do you have me mixed up for somebody else? Because, you know, I don't have any kind of, you know, any kind of music that's even close, but I love it, right? But, you know, how is it going to be possible? And they go, no, no, it's you, you know? And so I listened to it and I could see that half of it was, had that depth and the width of something I would have done with Coldplay. But the other part was really Andy Wallace, right? And Kevin Shirley had been making all their records. And, you know, he's got a great sound and it's just present and it's loud. And I was like, man. And I had maybe 4 or 5 different guitar sounds in my arsenal. That was it. You know, if you didn't like the first four, I said, okay, we'll try this. And you go like that. I go, uh-oh, well, I'll go back to one again, you know. But everything else I had, you know, a huge range. But for guitar sounds and how mean or how, you know, it should be. And so I started listening. I go, well, I got to get this together. So every day for about a week or two before I started mixing the record, on the subway, I'd listen to an Andy Wallace record. Whatever he was doing, I would listen just carefully to how, what the guitars and how the guitars were sitting, right? And then when it came to time to mix, after the first day, John had already said, well, I don't like that guitar sound. Try this, try that. And I was already running out of ideas. So I called Kevin, you know, and I said, Kevin, who's a friend of mine, and I said, Kevin, man, I'm mixing, you know, Dream Theater, and how do you get the guitar sound? So he said, okay, you know, get yourself a drummer EQ and get yourself, it was some really cheap Cosmo, I think, a widener, you know, $25 Cosmo or something. And he goes, do these EQs, do that EQ. And so I ordered it overnight. You know, the next day I went in. And I mean, I was able to pull off the first day, no problem, you know. But it was nerve-wracking for me.
Sure, yeah.
So next day I came in and I had my you know, new toys. And he goes, you know, I'm looking for this. And I was like, bang. He goes, oh, that's perfect. And I was like, thank you, Kevin. Nice. It's good to have friends, you know.
Absolutely, to a degree. Sometimes you got to give people what they expect. I mean, sometimes you got to break those expectations. But to be honest, it's refreshing to hear you being afraid of comparing your work to other people, because I can especially remember this back when I was a musician. There's certain records that I would listen to where they would be so good that they wouldn't make me feel good about making music. They would make me want to die. And I definitely remember that experience. And what you're talking about doing is something that comes up again and again for living a happier life and overcoming fear in your own life, which is comparing yourself to you yesterday instead of comparing yourself to some other mixer now. And that is probably something that a lot of people could fold into their lives better. And if you were to take out this conversation that you should disregard what I said about studying other people's work and listen to Michael Brauer instead, well, you know, that probably wouldn't be the worst decision in the world either.
Well, you know, that's the whole point of Mix with the Masters, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you got people who love, you know, you become a fan. The way it starts is it's so hard to even find credits anymore, right? So you listen to like 4 or 5 records that you love. Then you find out that it's the same guy who's been mixing all of them.
Yeah.
So you go, wow, I'm a fan.
Yeah.
You didn't know you were a fan until you realize that, you know, you bring up 4 or 5 records and it's the same guy that did them. So then you go, well, what else has he done? You go, oh, I like that too. Then you find out that the guy's going to teach for a week and he's available for a week. And you go, well, I really like that sound. I have no idea how he does it. Boom.
Yeah. So maybe the time for studying people closely comes two times. One, when you're in the beginning and you're kind of finding your own voice and you're trying to get inspiration and trying to find your own voice, you kind of examine what other things sound like really, really closely. And maybe you're doing more comparison at the very beginning, because you knew the work of some of these people you were assisting for was great because you were hearing it. As much as you said, I'm not listening to the work of other people, I think you mean I'm not comparing it directly. You were hearing the work that other people
did. Yeah, I mean, I was definitely hearing and listening to the guys that I was assisting.
You just weren't APing it with your current mix that's up on the desk.
Well, I wouldn't even dare to do that, but I wasn't listening to outside records,
right.
Outside, gotcha. You know, people outside of Media Sound,
because right.
Media Sound was closed.
Yeah.
There was staff engineers, and so was Electric Lady, and so was Hit Factory, and so was Olympic, so was, you know, Trident, you name it. You know, they had their own little group of people, and they, all the secrets stayed inside.
Right, interesting. But it's still, you end up hearing a lot of commercial releases if you're working at a place like Media Sound. So
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess that's one time is when you're beginning and studying the work of your colleagues really closely. And then, like you said, when you have you need inspiration or you're feeling stuck. And I imagine that happens to a lot of people who go to the mix to the with the masters kind of away seminars, that probably a lot of these people feel like they need some kind of jump start or recharge in their career or their process. And have you found that those experiences really change people going forward? If they go to one of those week-long seminars, do you keep in touch with any students who, like past students of these things? And
oh yeah, I do.
What are the outcomes for them, like a year out, 2 years out, 3 years out? Does it change the way they go about things? What are some of the interesting stories you've heard?
I've had, you know, you'll run into these guys at AES or one of the conventions, or sometimes they'll just write you.
Right.
You know? But they walk away going, wow, you changed my life. It's exactly what I was looking. And it's not about, well, this is how you EQ. It's about our philosophy. Because one of the things that I ask everyone to do when they're teaching is it shouldn't be like a classroom setting. It's really talking about, how do you think? Why do you approach this song in that way? And that's what they want to know, because techniques and EQs and stuff, that's relative to how it was recorded or to today's sound. A year from now, that drum sound isn't going to be it's old.
Right.
Right. So it's about, how do you think? Why, when you get up in the morning, you know, what do you got in your mind that leads you to walk into this room and just kick ass every day? You know, what is it that you're thinking about? And that's what, you know, I ask all the guys to share, because that's so much more important. And so that by the end of the week, this magic that they think you're doing, you know, or they're sure you're doing, isn't so magical anymore. It's something that is approachable. They can probably do it themselves. That's the point of the seventh, after the seventh day, that they leave going, how? I can do this. I can't wait to go home. And I'll hear from them. I go, I got a number one in my country. Or, you know, I'm using most of the approach of the Brower Eyes. I love it. It's just great. It's just made such a difference. And the first people who are saying are my regular clients. They're like, I'm blowing their minds. Because, you know, what happens? It's not just that the sound is better. The songs have more energy, have more... the story is being told so much better, right? And that's what all of us are doing for that 1 week. It's just about, well, you know, what are you thinking about when you're mixing? Because when I listen, there's a point the last couple of days where I listen to everybody's material. I go, where's the focus on here? I mean, I have no idea what this story is about.
Right.
Oh, but it sonically sounds good, but who cares?
And this is one of the interesting things to me about listening to some of your work, because you're a guy who, your name precedes you, you know, in some circles with like, oh, Brower, you know? And I remember hearing some Coldplay records that you did, and I wasn't knocked out necessarily by how hi-fi they were. And if anything, like I was expecting this sip test thing where it's like, oh my goodness, the treble and bass, they're just so glossy. What it was instead is that you know exactly where you're supposed to be looking or listening at any given time. The song has energy and forward momentum. The structure feels right. And of course, a lot of that is arrangement and writing and all of that. But it wasn't about the, oh, I'm going to take a quick sip and we have this perfect big bottom and big top. It was exactly what you said, focus. And the same thing happened with Grizzly Bear. When I heard, oh my goodness, Grizzly Bear is going to do a record with Michael Brauer and he's going to give it the big studio treatment. And I listened to this record and it, you know, sounded like a garagey, like 1960s thing where the kick drum is this little almost kind of marshmallowy pillow, but it was perfect because it's like it wasn't an impressive sounding kick drum that had been kick replaced and has all this click and all this mass, but it was aesthetically conjured up this world that they were trying to bring you into. And it's a world of the past a little bit. And I just thought that was interesting. I'm like, man, only a guy like Brauer could have the balls to make a kick drum sound like that and not feel like he has something to prove with how a kick drum's supposed to sound. And that is something that made me say, that's another level of technique when you can step back from trying to impress people and step into what are we trying to do with this song? And that really spoke to me.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I prepared myself for this record for a long time. I had wanted to become as transparent as possible. And who was going to call me to mix an indie record when I have all these other power pop records or this, you know, this or that. And so what I spent a year doing was basically stopping the go-to things that I would go to, you know, how I would go to this drum sound or how I would do this guitar sound or how I would do, you know, that I've completely got out of my comfort zone, which I do every 4 or 5 years anyway. But this one was specifically the only way you can get a record like this is if you don't sound at all like what is somebody is predicting that you would do, which is exactly how you described it. And so, you know, obviously a lot of this has to do also with Chris and the way he brought the record to me because the roughs already sounded like they were like 80, 90% there. You know, he's not only a producer, he's also, you know, and a songwriter, you know, he's also an engineer and he's in a mixer, right? So, you know, but he didn't want to mix this record, but he wanted to trust somebody who wouldn't try to, you know, reinvent what he had done. He just wanted somebody to make what he had better. And, you know, and he discovered that because I had mixed a record for George Lewis, Twin Shadows. And he had produced a record with him and he was like, wow, all you did with that record was just kind of control the chaos a little bit as opposed to try to clean it up, right? And I said, yeah, I just wanted to focus the chaos, not try to control it. And he says, if you could do that, then you'd be perfect for my record. And I had been doing this over the years with people who didn't really want their record touched, but either the label insisted on it, you know, and so I would just very, very careful about maintaining the integrity of their record. And with Grizzly Bear, it was exactly that. You know, I just wanted to improve a little bit here, a little bit there. And those little steps came out really big, but I didn't want the biggest compliment is you know, not knowing that I would have mixed that record.
Right. Yeah.
That's the biggest compliment because that's what I wanted to achieve. I wanted somebody to go, there's no way he would mix that. And then I was like, good, thank you.
Nice. Well, mission accomplished. No,
mission accomplished.
Here's a question for a guy who has been trying to reinvent his process around the edges bit by bit, you know, every 4 or 5 years for the past 45 years almost. When you have been involved with Mixed with the Masters, I imagine that some of these, but not all of these seminars, you have some firsthand experience in. Maybe you're coaching them on what they're going to teach. Maybe you're actually sitting through, you know, some of the instruction that some of these other
None
guys
of that.
Have given. All right.
I just have a talk with them. And I go, look, here's a philosophy. Please stick to that. You really have to open yourself, the deep inside of you. That's what you have to articulate because that's what's going to mean a lot more. That will change their life, not your technique. And that's it, you know. And for most of them, I've had that conversation. A few kind of slipped by and I didn't had a chance. But I also am keeping in tabs as to how they all are doing. right? Because again, it's very, very important that this philosophy be maintained. It doesn't get washed out. It doesn't get changed. You know, as years go by, no matter what it is, you know, people start changing what your original philosophy is. It's just because, you know, one says it, unless they're all hearing it from me directly, somebody's, it's like the talking in a can, you know, or passing the word around the table. You know, by the end, it gets to the sixth person, it's a whole other story. So, you know, it's very important because these people are coming from all over the world. And they're not there just to witness something or just curious. Some of them literally have mortgaged their house. It's crazy, right? But they're really, they're just at this point, they're either jaded or they just don't know what to do. So they're not looking just on how to improve their mixing. They're looking to see what it is that can get that energy and that excitement back in what they used to once love, which was music.
Right.
And now they don't love it anymore. They're scared of it or they hate it or, you know. And they come here and we, one of the things we do is we try to focus on each person individually during that week. There's only like 14 or 15 people. So you got plenty of time. And I asked them when they first arrive, I go, okay, stand up. The more honest you are, the more I can help you. Why are you here? And you'll hear all the answers, you know, you'll hear why they're here. And you go, okay, well, I got a week to focus on that. You know, as I'm teaching, I'm thinking about which way to say it. Now, I quite often say the same thing 10 different ways.
Right. Now, a question for you. You've probably seen a lot of people get stuck. A lot of people get jaded. And a lot of people get unstuck. We teased in the beginning this idea of, you know, overcoming some of the fears of mixing. What are some of the, in your experience dealing with people, A, through Mix with the Masters and just in the industry in general, what are some of the most common things people get stuck on in the production or the mixing stage? What are some of the things that are holding people back the most? And what are some of the things that are really helping them break through?
Well, production, I'll leave that to the producers. For mixing, I think the problem is coming in not knowing where you want to go with this mix. And one of the first things I bring up is, okay, what do you feel when you're listening to this song? Okay, that's problem number one. Mm-hmm. You don't quite know. And so what happens when you're starting to balance and you're getting a guitar sound? Well, you know, there's like 15 different ways to get a good guitar sound. And so you get confused and you'll get hung up on it because you don't know which one to go with. And so I said, look, you're missing something important here. What is this song? What's the energy on it? Is this a happy song? You know, think about which of the four emotions is it? For me, it's one of four. It's going to be happy. It's going to be sad, which, you know, subcategory of lonely or something. Angry or physical. Physical is like the club, right, where the vocal isn't really more important than one of the instruments. You know, it's supposed to get you up and moving. That's physical. So I go, when you're sitting there and you sit down, you go, what's going on with this song? Is this a song that, you know, has hope, but there's a lot of tension in it? Is it happy, but really you listen to the bridge and you go, no, this story isn't as happy as, you know, she's pretending it to be. So think about that and apply it to who you are. The one thing that all of us as humans have in common is that we understand all these emotions. What makes us unique is how we interpret. How did we experience sadness? There is sadness that is beyond what any of us could possibly imagine, or anger beyond what any of us can imagine, right? So how are you going to interpret that so it's unique to you? And when you're mixing a song, you're going to have everybody going, oh, wow, that I get this song because of your approach to it. And so as you're going for that guitar EQ, think about, what's this song about? What's the emotion you want from this? And if it's too clean, you know, is that feel right for this song? Or is this right for this section that maybe it needs to be clean, but then in the bridge, it should be really, really dirty. Okay. So what does that mean? So now you don't have to worry about five different good sounding EQs or reverbs or something. You just go, this one makes me feel angry. Okay, good. Now move on.
Right.
Same thing with the bass, same with the drums, same thing, you know, and then look at the whole picture of what are you trying to do? Because balancing, anybody can do. Mm-hmm. It's not about the balancing. It's about how are you going to portray the story?
Yeah.
What is this artist's story? And you want to get that vision out there, and how you do it, and how common what your approach is to the common ear, right? If you make something and only your best friends like it, that's the chances of it getting out there and having a lot of people also love it is slim. On the other hand, if you do it a certain approach and 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people, because the song has been able to get out there, understand that and it affects them in a way that's very positive, then that would to me be the common ear. And you're going to be getting calls again because they like how you interpret happy. They like how you interpret sadness or anger, mm-hmm. or physical, right? And so that's where the uniqueness comes in. And that's why, you know, when you ask me about the mid-range, well, that's all part of my who I am, yeah. And I don't think about do I need to brighten this at this EQ or that EQ? I don't know that, but I also know if I want to put some kind of weird tension into a section, I may EQ a guitar a certain way, and then what I realize later is I'm bringing out the ninth, or I'm bringing out a second in it, and it's giving it a rub, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I don't think about that. I just go, I want to feel like, I don't want to feel so good, you know? And so I tweak and I push, and next thing I know, I go, oh, that feels good. Do I look at what I do? Do I care? Will I notate it so I can do it again tomorrow? No, I don't care. Mm-hmm. All I know is I'm here. It's like I get on the train and I want to get off at the right stop kind of mm-hmm. thing, you know? And so it's just led by how do I feel. So I'm constantly making those judgment calls strictly by emotion. I'm a mixer who is just trying to bring the emotion out of a song. And I may go in 5 or 6 directions on the way.
Right. So you're feeling your way through it every step of the way.
I'm feeling my way through it, and I hope I get out at the right stop.
So how do you know when you're done? So if there's no overarching vision, how do you know when you're done?
Because I don't have any more ideas. Mm-hmm. I don't have any more, you know, for me, when I listen to the 3/4 of the process is I'm not thinking. I'm strictly going by impulse, which is what I've been describing about, you know, this feels good. This feels good. This doesn't feel good. I don't do this. This is too busy. This is right. I'll focus on this more. Then I go back to the rough mix. Okay. I'm in the ballpark. Oh, wow. That rough mix is so much better. Okay, why? Okay, all right. Oh, I get it. All right, boom, 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 boom. Make those changes. Back to what I'm doing. Back to continuing on mixing. And then once I've kind of turned automation on and I've got everything going and I've been doing my rides and I'm feeling, you know, there's an excitement, then I listen to it through my little boom box. And that's when I take a break. 5-10 minute break, and I sit back down and I put my walking in hat, you know, the producer hat comes in and is now listening to what I've just done. You know, you ever had like you've mixed a song and then the producer comes in, the artist in, and suddenly you don't even recognize your mix anymore? Have you ever had that where you go, oh my God, now I hear this, now I hear that, and you just start to feel embarrassed because for some reason you're listening through their ears,
right?
So that used to happen to me all the time. And it was incredibly scary to me that I didn't hear it the first time around. So then I started imagining I was that person walking into the room, and I would sit there and listen to my mix, and I would not be Michael. You know, I'd be the guy walking in going, all right, let's hear this song. I don't know. That's about the only way I can describe it. Just become somebody else coming in and listening to it. I'm a little bit more objective. And then there's a list of things I should change. And so I'd make those changes. Once I'm done with that, you know, maybe I'll take another little break and I'll listen to it and I'll listen back on the big speakers. I'll go, man, this feels really good. I'm done. Okay, that's it. I'm done. I don't need to suffer or listen to it for another 5 days or, oh, I have to stop now because I could go on forever. No, I couldn't go on forever. I feel good. It's done. Okay, it's 3.5, 4 hours. That's plenty of time. Now, it's going to be sent off. The artist is going to have comments, or the producer is going to have comments, or the label is going to have comments, or the management's going to have comments. And then you take all that in, you go, okay, all right, let's see, you know, what they're, you know, quite often it's just little things that aren't going to change the direction. They're loving the direction of the song. They just maybe want a drier vocal, or they want a little drier drum sound, or are they this, or, you know, or it's levels up and down. But I'm done. You know, it felt good to me. I didn't send it off at 80% or something. It feels done to me. So now let the artist, it's his record or her record. Let's hear what you got and let's see how we can improve it.
Yeah. Now, as far as comments and revisions go, that's probably something that's changed in the industry dramatically over the years.
Oh.
When you were beginning to now. And I imagine that one of the driving factors in your change of setup may have been the ability to handle comments and revisions. Is that a...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I used to have to put aside 3 days when I mixed an album for recalls. And they would attend the recall and they'd make all the changes. And that would be kind of it. You know, it's like I've just put the console, you know, recalled everything on the console, all my 7 racks of gear. And now we're going to make some tweaks. But those times changed. There was a point where, you know, and so you could, my guys were good. So I could do 3-4 songs in a day. It was a long day, right? But we could recall. Each recall took like 1.5 hours easily to just to recall and then match it, make sure it's perfect. But then there would be a point where they stopped attending and you wouldn't hear from them for 3 or 4 days. So, you know, and then they'd make comments and then they'd make more comments and then more comments. Well, you can't keep recalling a desk, right? So that's when we started, all of us started printing stems. But then you have to know, yeah, but if you print stems and it isn't linked, you know, there's a side chain going on that makes every stem think that it's in the stereo mix. Because as you know, when you've got everything being compressed a certain amount, it's because they're all working together by, you know, and again, my approach kind of took that out as an issue because I'm doing sub-stereo compression, blah, blah, blah.
So but do you not have a main bus compressor on after
I do.
All those bus compressors? So there are,
I do.
It first hits those 4 bus compressors before getting to a main.
That, the sound is coming from there. And then the glue factor comes later. But you know, in order to do stems, we had to make sure that we had to be able, and the SSL had it. It had a side chain. So you would send your unprocessed stereo mix into the sidechain, and then you would do your stems. I don't want to get geeky on that. I'm just trying to explain that it became quite difficult and time-consuming. You're looking at 3 hours of stems, because you're doing like 40 stems, right? And then got to check. I mean, these guys, and if I was mixing 2 songs a day, you know, they'd have to mix. That's 6 hours of post-production easily after I'm done, right? So yeah, so what we would do is, you know, once the stems were done, then rarely would I go back to the console again, right? Because the stems are all, you know, unless it's a complete different, you know, we got to start from, you really missed this one. We got to look at it completely different. Okay, that's a remix. But otherwise, you just work off the stems or work off the stereo mix, and then you're introducing the stems, you know, to right. add or
but
subtract.
Today, it's like opening up a word processor document. You pick up where you left off, and then but then you go to your analog gear and have Fernando set the controls back where they were, and that's a lot easier process for sure.
It takes like 10, 15 minutes because, you know, the only thing that I'm really futzing with are my mastering racks, so to speak, right? Where I got the EQs and all stuff like that. But all my individual gear, I rarely touch except for the reverbs, right? I'm going to change reverbs. I'm going to change delays. And he's going to notate all that. But everything else, if it's an EQ or a compressor, if it doesn't sound right with that, I'll find another one. But I won't touch them anymore, you know, rarely.
So people are going to crucify us, Michael, if we don't go into gear a little bit and ask a little bit about what's changed, what's different, and what are you relying on your setup today? Are you using plugins more now than in the past? Where are you using hardware? And what are a couple pieces that are essential to you that you're glad you're not without?
Well, I've been using plugins. In the beginning, I didn't use plugins because it looked like a Pultec, but it didn't sound like a Pultec, right? So the GUI was a lot better than the sonics of it.
Yes.
But then Sound Toys and UAD and Waves and PSP and you're going to crucify me for the ones that I didn't bring up, but, you know, all these other ones that just came up with great sounding plugins. And then most important, the software tools, like what Isotope has, right? I mean, that RX is just crazy. It's so important. The day doesn't go by that we don't have RX. We're using Isotope in one shape or another as a tool. So I've been using, you know, I don't even think whether I'm using a plugin or hardware anymore because I approach software just like I did hardware. I use it on everything until I get to really know it well. And there's millions out there. It's overwhelming. I have a friend who'll call me and goes, you know, blah, 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 software. I go, please don't do that, man. You're making me...
I don't need anymore.
It's so intimidating. I can't. My brain can't handle... learning one more plugin, you know. Before it was like, well, how much money did you have, you know, to get this really cool hardware? Now it's like, you can have a million plugins, you know, but you can have a million and not know any of them. What good are they? So you know, I have a batch that are my favorites that I use every day that I can just call on and I know them really well. And generally, you know, if I'm looking for a certain type of room sound on the drums or a certain tom or a certain bass. I mean, I have my hardware or I have my software. And for hardware, for example, for bass, I always split my bass up. I mold it out so that I have, you know, the bass coming up on two channels. And one of them, I process it so that it's like the neck, right? The articulation. Mm-hmm. So that if you want to hear the bass line a lot better, you can just bring the neck up because you don't necessarily want all the bottom end to come up. You just want the articulation to better. Or sometimes your articulation is too much and you just want more of the body. So you just, right? So I've been doing that for years and it works great for me. But I almost always do the neck so far.
Show bass. Us your racks.
Thanks, sweetie.
You're looking that way. Yeah. So you're saying that part of your process is for the bass going into some of this hardware. What hardware in particular?
So can you see my finger over here? That's a modified 436B Altec, which I almost always use for the neck of the bass. And then further down, way down here, there's an EAR, and over here there's a 737. There's a 176. So how do I want that bottom end to sound? that EAR tends to make it sound, you get nice low end, but it tends to give it a nice little bit of a natural growl, while the 737 Avalon is just more precise and it's quick and it just has a certain sound. Like whenever I put it on an acoustic bass, I don't know what it just always sounds good, right? So depending on the song, I generally leave the neck going through the Altec, but the body will change.
Is hardware still part of your process when it comes to the browerizing thing that you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. It is still 100%. I mean, I've already been toying with everything in the box, and it's sounding pretty good. I mean, I know a lot of people are already doing it their own way. When I release it the way I want it, everybody will know about it. But
fair enough.
I still use my, you know, originally when I was mixing, my stereo mix was a 33609 going into Pultex. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when a mix I'm doing, it sounds too rich and too kind of too big or too expensive or too whatever it is. And when I hear them say that, I go, go back to my traditional approach and I'll just get rid of all the multi-bus and just everything goes through A. And then poof, that's exactly what they're looking for. So, you know, this whole approach that I developed is because it addresses any and all options.
Yeah. Now, since you've talked about this in public in a few different places, you had a great write-up of your approach in Tape Op where you went into some detail about years back. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version of it for those who just aren't familiar, a Cliff Notes version of how you approach the buses?
Interestingly, next month, I think, or the next 2 months, the update to that article from 15 years ago.
Oh, sweet.
Larry Crane is putting out. So he interviewed me, I think, about a month or two ago.
All right.
So
look forward to that.
There's a 2.0 to this whole thing. But all right. Oh, boy. This part I don't like. All right. To try and describe what it is, it started out as multi-bus compression. Mm-hmm. So that and why? Because I felt that everything being compressed by one stereo compressor was too controlling. Mm-hmm. And the bottom end obviously is what triggers the compressor the easiest. So if you add a whole lot of bottom end and you've got a fairly loud vocal, the vocal might start to drop. You know, and so then you got to backtrack and then you've got to have less going into the compressor. It's for me, it was just, I got to a point where I realized that that traditional approach would never work for me. At some point, my career would be over because I just was constantly running with this problem of everything being affected by one stereo compressor.
And at that time, you didn't think to turn to multi-band compression. I guess multi-band compression wasn't as well developed then as it is today.
It didn't exist, and two, it would never have resolved my problem. Mm-hmm. Because everything, this whole approach was kind of based on pre-compression. Stereo approach where you put a process, you know, compression across the insert and you squash it all you want. And then no matter how loud or how quiet you put the fader, it's already processed. Mm-hmm. It's already compressed, right? Mm-hmm. And I wanted independence between instruments. So multi-bus, what's it called? Multi-compression.
Multi-band compression?
Multi-band, thank you, compression wouldn't apply here.
Right.
So I wanted to. When I got a great sound on the bass and the drums and where my compressors were working just beautifully, mm-hmm. right? I didn't want to have that ruined by adding too many other instruments to that same compressor, mm-hmm. right? You start adding guitar and you start adding other things and suddenly that cool sound you had on the drums disappears. Mm-hmm. So I wanted independence from that. I wanted the guitars. I could do whatever I want with them. And plus guitar, the attack and release, I wanted always very, very different than what I wanted the drums. Drums needed to be like a let it through real quick and then grab it, you know, like that the distressor, but, you know, with a British setting in. And the guitars, I wanted to be just a little bit little slower, you know, and if you really hit the compressor hard, it would shimmer. I wanted that, right? And then I wanted also my traditional Neve 33609 and Pultex for things that were sustaining. Mm-hmm. Piano, synths, strings, horns, all of that. That would now go through, that would be bus A. So you don't look at it as I'm processing top, middle, and bottom. I'm approaching it, the bottom end of the record doesn't mean the EQ, and the bottom end of the record has full bandwidth. The bottom end of the record is the anchor, generally, which is the drums and the bass. That would be the bottom of the record. The middle of the record would be the guitars, not from an EQ standpoint, but from where its importance is in a song, right? And that would be the middle. So I would call that bus C, C for center.
Oh.
And B was, you know, bus B had the distressors and the Avalon EQs across them. And then A was my original. That would be just all around. You know, that was just that beautiful, rich Neve 33609, you know, silky sound. And then D was more like a widener. Mm-hmm. So I threw it, you know, that eventually became Edward the compressor. It's this red one over here.
Pretty.
That one. Right. So when I was on an analog desk, that's what I did. And everything returned to, you know, A, B, C, D on the SSL. And so as I'm mixing, I realized that to get the sound, I'm actually mixing into compression, right? So that if I don't have the faders up enough, there's no compression going on. But if I push it too hard, the compressors are like jammed and I have no sound. So the best spot was where the compressors would play. So you know, it hit the compressor and then it would bounce back. So there was like this automatic movement without my actually even moving any faders yet. It was just playing. And so it took time to learn how to calibrate all these compressors. So they all, you know, kind of compress the same amount but played in different ways. And, you know, and in a nutshell, although it's a very long nutshell, I was just trying to get more freedom between the instruments and get more natural emotion out of it and not be constrained to everybody being compressed and processed by one. And what I realized during this process is that what I was doing was mixing into compression. So I had completely changed my approach to mixing without realizing it so that it was post-compression. And that's the world that I started living in, which meant that my window is a bit smaller. I had to be in that window. But in time, it you know, I live it. I live there.
It makes a lot of sense, Michael. And it's very interesting to me because I'm pretty sure it was with you. I remember a quote from you in some magazine somewhere at some point saying that early on in your career, you couldn't hear the sound of compression. And I think a lot of people have been there, you know, when they're starting off, and that's one of the last things for people to master. At what point did it start to come together for you? And is there anything that people can do to kind of jumpstart that process a little bit? Like, what were the things that finally gave you breakthroughs in being able to hear compression?
Do it badly a lot?
For a while?
I did it so badly. I had one engineer, after I'd mixed this record, it was Mike Barbiero, had been called in by management, you know, of the studio, so you got to, you know, he came in, they asked him to listen because the artist had complained that my mix was so tiny that it didn't matter how loud the volume went. It was the same level. So goodness, I'm at home and Mike calls me and he goes, so Brower, come in here. We got to talk. And I'm like, oh, I hate that word. Mm-hmm. So I came in and he's playing me this mix, which I thought I'd done really well, right? And he goes, so check this out, Brower. You know, and he takes the volume. Now, watch this. I'm going to make it louder, right? So he makes it louder, and I go, oh. He goes, yeah, it doesn't sound any louder. The bottom end doesn't get any bigger. It, you know, and he goes, now look. Now I'm playing it low. Look, it's the same level. And I was like, he goes, what did you do? He goes, you compressed this thing so much that it's practically flatline, which today probably would be sounding great. Right. But that's a side note.
Yeah.
And so I completely, I've just about passed out. I mean, all the blood drained from my face, and I don't think I touched another compressor for maybe 6 months after that. But I got to learn. We only had three or four compressors, and in the beginning, the guys would, you know, say, "Okay, put the LA-2A across that." I go, "Okay," and we had LA-2A, LA-3A, 1176, Roger Mayer, some other esoteric ones, but basically that was it for compressors. We didn't have any Fairchilds at Media. And I'd go between them and I go, why? I don't hear any difference between your LA-3A and the LA-2A. And I'm thinking to myself, of course, I'm not saying, you know, I don't hear any difference. I'm like, I'm fucked. That's all I could think. I was like, I don't hear why he's doing this, right? And then I started, you know, going to my close friends and going, hey, so who cares between LA-2A and LA-3A? You know, what do you mean? I go, I don't hear any difference. And then so they say, all right, well, just start playing with them. Just keep playing with just an LA-2A on everything for hours. And of course, I lived in the studio. I was there 7 days a week. So if I wasn't on a session, I was doing something. Right, I was doing my side projects, which were back then we were allowed to do. And I guess it just happened over time where I started going, oh, I see why the 1176 doesn't sound like the LA-2A. Mm-hmm. You know, when I put it across this guitar, it is more driven, or it's a bit more urgent when I use the 1176. And the same with the vocal. And then if I put all the buttons in, wow, it's even crazier. But I can't get that on the LA-2A. So, you know, but I like the LA-2A on the bass. Well, not on this bass because it's too syncopated. That it feels like it's not articulating enough anymore, right? So that's how all these things slowly, but it was a frightening experience because I just didn't hear it for the first couple of years. And I'm like, if I don't hear it, what am I doing in this business? Mm-hmm. You know, but bottom line is that I just stuck to it and just hoped that I'd get over it or get past it. And I did. And then, you know, it's ironic because now, you know, I know process, I know compressors really well.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I made my weakness my biggest strength, you know. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Now, you've seen a lot of people who were assistants with you back at Media Sound, or even who were engineers when you were an engineer, and you've had a lot of assistants yourself, and there's a lot of attrition, I think, in the audio and music industry. There are people who just drop out of it. I'm sure that some of the assistants you've had went on to do great things, and some of them maybe dropped out of the field. Some of the people you're assisting alongside probably dropped out of the field. What are those factors that you think keep people in it for the long haul and keep people having sustainable careers in this industry? Are there any factors you could point to, common threads between the people who are going to make this into a long-term career and the people who are going to fizzle out and just bail on it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's fizzling out or bailing necessarily. It's you realize at some point that this isn't what you love. I mean, a lot of people started I started with 10 people, I think, 10 or 12. And only one was left by the time we were staff engineers. And he went on to, I don't know, I think he ended up doing live show for a while and then something else, you know. And I had so few of us continued because it takes so many things to come together to stay in this business. One, you have to have the right personality. You don't have to be the greatest engineer. You just have to be able to have the kind of personality where people like to hang out with you for 12 hours in a room with no windows, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you think you know everything and you're too opinionated and you're opinionating on things when you're not even being asked to, so they'll find somebody else, mm-hmm. right? And so I noticed that. I noticed also, I think, those who just didn't evolve at the same rate that the music was evolving. I mean, that was, I think, the biggest problem for many of them, where they worked so hard to make a great record, right? And along comes a band that is perfect for them. They've got some unique sounds as an engineer or approach, and boom, suddenly now after all this time, they hit big. And then they go, okay, now I can relax. Mm. Now I've got, this is my sound. Well, by the time the record comes out, that sound is already 3 or 4 months old. If you happen to win some award, now it's a year old. And if it's really good sound, everybody's going to want to do it. So now it's not even fresh. So now what? You know, so what are you going to do? You keep saying, well, this is my sound. Well, yeah, but they'll go, yeah, but that sound is kind of old. So, you know, as a mixer, it's not an easy gig in the sense that you can't just sit back on your laurels and your awards. You have to stay out of that comfort zone. You know, you have to evolve that's why I say every 4 or 5 years, you got to keep evolving and try something new and keep changing it up so that you new, fresh, young bands are seeking you out. They don't care about your age. They care about the records they like that happen to be associated with you.
So how do you keep up? Where do you look for inspiration when you know that you have to change things around, particularly when you say you're not closely studying the work of other mixers specifically? How do you keep your ear to the ground, get a sense for what's forward looking and what isn't and all that?
Because there's music around us every day, mm-hmm. every moment, whether you're listening to television or you're in a cab or you're walking down the street or you go to a club. Right? It's there. It's just background stimuli that's just constantly coming in. And at any point in time, my brain is going, oh, and I'll take that, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm not going out to study it. I'm just going, oh, that's cool. Oh, I like where that kick and bass is going lately. I like that, you know? And that's it. It's a passing thought. But I also know that I have to absolutely work. Once I've been comfortable for a while, I go, okay, all right, party's over. I got to start thinking about what to do now. What am I going to do to change stuff up? Obviously, I'm still evolving as I'm hearing what's going on around me, but then I got to challenge myself again and try something that makes me really uncomfortable until it becomes comfortable. And the Grizzly Bear was a perfect example. You know, the third Coldplay record. I didn't do the second. I did the first. The third one, I spent a year and a half coming up, figuring out how to get the kind of sound. I was expecting to do it on the second one. That didn't happen, but it was perfect for the third one. And by the time third record came out, I had been developing ideas for a year on how do I mix. The tendency now is to have very quiet, empty verses and absolutely smacking choruses. I mean, huge, and every chorus got bigger and wider and deeper, right? Mm-hmm. Well, how do you do that physically? I mean, you only have about 3 dB of dynamic, right? At the most. So how are you going to do that? And that's what I spent a good year and a half trying to figure out. And so none of my go-to stuff was working, and I just spent every time there was an opportunity for that kind of a record to come out. And the one where I really developed it and nailed it was on the Athlete record. I'd expected to mix the second Coldplay record. When that didn't happen, all that, because I kind of predicted where they were going to be going. When that didn't happen, along comes Athlete, and I applied all of that to Athlete, and they were doing those very exact things I've been working on throughout a whole album. So when you listen to X and Y and you listen to Athlete, you can understand what I had achieved on Athlete I applied to X and Y. So again, it's not something that I just sit around and wait for a record and do nothing. I work. I really, really work towards, you know, figuring out what to do to address certain approaches to mixing, which is how this whole, you know, multibus, which eventually turned into Brower Eyes, only because it's not multi-bus anymore. It's parallel. It's send return. And it was actually, it was one of the guys that in Coldplay, guy who, you know, who had coined it. Hey, we need to browerize this. And I was like, oh, well, that'll work. You know, that's easy. Because I was like, I can't call this multi-bus compression anymore. What am I going to call it? I go, all right, well, if he's going to call it that, I'll call it that. And so
may all of us live long enough and do well enough in our lives to have our name become a verb.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, you know, I know you don't have all day for us. I really appreciate all the time you've given to us so far. A couple last questions for you, if I can, before we let you go. One is, we talked a little bit about your philosophy and your approach, but we didn't really go into, I'm just curious for the details. There's a couple of them. Do you have an order of operations that you normally go through? Like, do you start in a certain way? Are there certain things you try to get together first?
Glad you asked that, Justin.
All right.
And the answer to that one is, I'd say 40% of the time I start with the drums and bass. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from a long time ago when I always started with drums and the bass. And by the time I got to the vocal, there was no room for it. And the mix just didn't sound right. And the drum sound wasn't right. And I have to start all over again.
Right.
And eventually I woke up one day and I go, why do I always start with drums and bass? It's because that's the way I was taught. Mm-hmm. Hey, the song was written on the piano. And the most important elements here are piano, vocal, and tambourine. Why don't we start with that?
Yeah.
Right. And so I would get a great sound, and that way the piano was sitting beautifully under the vocal and the tambourine was right in the same right place. And I go, okay, now what am I going to add? Well, why don't I add some bass to that? Mm. So it just sits right below. And then, of course, I'm EQing the bass so that it works with the three main elements. Mm-hmm. And then I would add some other instruments. I go, wow, that guitar is too busy. Mute. Okay. Here's this guitar. Okay. Where should that go? Oh, that'll go right here. That left sounds good, but it's sounding muddy. So I'll clean out some mid range and I'll add some upper mid range and, you know, oh, now it sits really well. Now I still can listen to the song. I got the piano, I got the vocal, everything is happy. If this was just being played in a club, you know, in a cafe, I could hear the story right here. This is good. Okay. Then I start adding more and more instruments. By the time I add the drums, I know exactly what that drum sound should be, right, and how to EQ it so that it sits in the track. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are times when I start like that. There are times when I start with vocal and guitar, or sometimes it's a really, really cool loop. And I know that the song is kind of based around, I'll start with the loop. Mm-hmm. So there is no one way to start the mix. The most important thing is to maintain what are the three most important elements in this song. And don't say drums, because quite often drums are support.
Right. So what kinds of songs are those where the drums and bass are the things to lead with? Like, how would you know, okay, this is the kind of track where we're going to do that instead of focusing on the most important?
I guess when I'm listening to the rough mix, I'm like, wow, everything is really based around this drums and bass.
That's a good answer.
So that's where I'll start, you know? Yeah. But when I go, wow, you know, the drums are just distracting me on this mix. You know, I'll start with, well, it sounds like the song was written on an acoustic guitar. Okay, so I'll start with the acoustic guitar and the vocal. And then I'll build around that. And I just found that when I do that, it just comes together so much faster.
Right. So figuring out what feel like the most important elements first, every once in a while, that's going to happen to be the drums and bass. But when it's not, it's not. And you go for those other things instead.
Yeah. Again, you know, ask yourself, what are the three most important elements here in the first verse? What are the three most important ones in the bridge or the B section or the chorus? You know, pick those out. Make sure that those are the three elements. And then also understand what is the important element and what is support? Who is supporting? Because if you play a support role and you make that, focus that as the main element when it's really supposed to be a support role, you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, the mix is going to, it's not focusing on the right elements.
Now, to help all this happen, are you a sectional mixer at all? Or are you kind of top to bottom going through the song? Or does it help you to zero in and say, I'm not going to start at the top of the song. I'm going to dive in here, get this right. And then.
Same thing. There is just, there are times when I go from the beginning to the end. There are other times where I go, wow, this is the most complicated, hardest part of the song. I can fix you, right? I didn't start at the beginning. I started mixing when all the drums came in and the major section. So I knew where my levels were. This is as loud as this mix can get, right? And that's what I spent all my time mixing. And I got to that point where I don't even remember what the beginning was yet. But here, this was feeling absolutely great, all right? And then I notated all my marks, right? Because I wasn't an automation, but I notated where all my faders were. And I went to the beginning. Now I knew where everything could sit so that it had somewhere to go. So there are times, I've been doing it recently, where I go, I just loop the chorus over and over and over, and I'm just building it and kind of studying it, getting to learn it. And to the point where I go, wow, this chorus feels great. And then I go back, or maybe I'll spend time on a verse. But it really varies. There are times when I don't do it, and there are other times I go, wow, you've been doing that lately. Is that something that you're going to be, you know, talking to myself, going, hey, you know, is this something you should tell people to do? I go, you know, it works. It works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't, you know. But there's, it changes. It just changes depending on the song.
Right, yeah. Michael, I've got to tell you, it's always refreshing to talk to you, because I think some people, if they all they've experienced of you is, say, that article in Tape Op or the next one that's about to come out where you go into geeky detail about your process, they might think that you're a very technical guy and a very methodical guy. But then it's like that's happening under the hood. And whenever I talk to you about this stuff, it's always about the feel. It's always about the artistry. It's always about emotion. And clearly to think in this way, you've got to really like music and like getting inside of it and living inside of it. So my last big question for you is, how do you keep loving music, you know, 40 years out? Because I think all of us, and maybe this has happened to you at some point, have fallen out of love with music for moments at a time, you know, and we have to get ourselves back into the spirit of it to do great work. So how do you keep on loving music? How do you keep on staying inspired to do what you do?
Well, that's a tough one to answer, and also the easiest, in the sense that a song has never betrayed me, has never cheated on me, has never fucked me, has never, you know, it might be really tough to find the soul of it, but I get so much back when I listen to a song. And I'm not a songwriter. And so just like everyone else, you know, when you go through good times or bad times, a songwriter can write it down and can write a song. And that's how they release it themselves, right? Of that. I can't do that. I do that through mixing a song. So when I'm really happy, or even, you know, even if I'm like really, really sad and I'm mixing a happy song, I can just transfer that into the energy of that song. You know, just bring out the emotion. But I get a lot back from mixing. So I'm always looking for a great song. I'm always looking. It's weird how there are times when I'm going through certain things in my life, I'm mixing a record that basically, you know, describes word for word what I'm going through, which obviously makes for even a more emotional and, you know, closer connection to what the singer is envisioning. And I've tried to keep the business side of it and the ups and downs. I mean, you know, this, my career is, as I think it is with many of my friends, it's like a roller coaster, but you want the roller coaster to slowly keep going up. You don't want it to go back to the start point, yeah. You know? And so you just keep going I know what I love to do. I love mixing music. That's so, I've been honest to that, and it's kept me going this many years, and I just haven't lost the faith in it. You know, the day that I walk away, I'll walk away, but I'm not going to walk away regretting anything. I just want to walk away maybe and start doing something else. Who knows? For that just hasn't entered my mind yet. I just love mixing a good song, you know? So that keeps me going. And I didn't get lazy or feel like my sound is the sound. It isn't. It's only good for today. And unless you keep evolving at the same rate as music, you'll end up doing music you don't want to do.
Right.
Right. And I don't want to be that. I fear that way more. So what's scarier? Getting out of your safe zone, right? Or out of your comfort zone, or not getting any calls.
Right.
Which one's scarier? I'll tell you. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Right.
Good point, man. Beautiful stuff. Now, if people wanted to hear more from you, where are the best places to find you online or in life?
No idea.
Well, Mix with the Masters, you know, is a good place. If people want some behind-the-scenes stuff, they can. I think they have free, trial subscriptions where they can actually watch some long-form videos.
Absolutely. And then you can see all of us doing mixing, deconstruction, or mixing from scratch. So you can definitely find me there, on Instagram occasionally. Mm-hmm.
You're not a big social media presence kind of guy.
Nothing like Chris.
Yeah, fair enough. All right.
So Chris is the king. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram under Michael Brower. You can find me Twitter, I think MHB850. And I rarely check in on the other ones. I'm just, you're right. I'm not as big as social hound as I should be, but I'm around.
Hey, all right. And you have been living in New York for pretty much like the vast majority of your life?
Yep. I was born here. I grew up in Paris, and then I came back here when I was 7, and I've been here ever since.
What keeps you in New York? Give me 3 things that you love about New York that would make you never want to leave.
Well, ask any New Yorker. The energy. The energy is crazy. It's just, you walk down that street and the pace is so fast, I was walking with a friend of mine from California. He goes, "Why are we running?" I go, "I'm not running. This is a pace. Look around. We're all walking at the same pace." And there's everything here. There's the theater, right? There's music. There's all these jazz clubs. You've got between Brooklyn and Manhattan, you've got, a dozen at least great venues for listening to music, which is just minutes away. It's a cab ride away. And the food is great here too.
True story.
So
one of the things that happened, a lot of audio engineers who have moved out to California this past decade. And one of the things that's weirded me out the most about California, as lovely as the weather is, and it's easy to envy that, is those people, when they're waiting to cross the street, they stay on the sidewalk. I don't understand it. They don't get into the street to wait for the light to change and then zip across. I think you get a ticket for that in California.
Yeah, you get a serious ticket. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons. Plus, I don't know that I see people on the sidewalk in LA.
Right.
Usually you get in your car, turn the air conditioning on, cross the street, park it, get out.
There you go. It's only at NAM when everyone's walking from their hotels. That's technically.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Michael Brower, it's been absolutely great to have you on. I feel like I could keep you going for another half an hour, and I desperately want to, but we have some time constraints on this. Great to talk to you. Big shout out to our sponsors again for helping make this kind of stuff possible. So big thanks to Isotope, which apparently Michael Brower is also a fan of. Check them out, isotope.com. You can try out anything that they make for free. Eventide, been making effects for about as long as Michael Brower has been making records, which is really saying something. Check them out at eventideaudio.com. You can check out any of their software for free. Or if you're into guitar pedals and stuff or rack effects, they make amazing stuff. And Sound Toys, probably like one of the most fun and iconic brands in software.
So, Sound Toys is great.
Yeah, check them out. Soundtoys.com. Try anything they make for free. Also, if you have not checked out Mix with the Masters, it is not only surprisingly affordable week-long workshops in France where you like live in a castle and have all your food made for you and you just got to pay the plane fare. It's not only that, it's also mixwiththemasters.com where you can go under the hood and behind the scenes. And you also, in addition, you do stuff that's just for the Mix with the Master subscribers, right? There's stuff that's made, purpose-made for the website.
Yeah.
So definitely check that out. It's a great resource, whether you're new in your career and want to learn from people like Michael Brower learned from people when he was an assistant, or if you've been doing this for a while and you need some inspiration or you need to change a thing or two about the way you work, like Michael Brower does every 4 or 5 years. All right, Michael, so good to have you on. I hope to have you back on sometime. I hope we'll get a flood of questions that people want to ask you the next time we have you on, and I hope that'll happen sometime. Michael, thanks again for joining us. It's been great to have you here. Truly honor and a privilege, and thank you guys for hanging out with us.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
See you next time.